Thank you, James. Thank you, Chair. Caroline, could you kindly close the door? Thank you and good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members of the committee and honorable members of the press. Chair, again, we are very happy to be here to report to our stakeholders on the progress of the implementation of the national policy and its action plan. With me here, Chair, I have the head of the national policy unit, Mr. Nimrod Clark, and his deputy, the director in the unit, and Nkosi Madu. Chair, as you and the members will know, that the Department of Trade and Industry is mandated to level the playing field in the economic sphere in South Africa. From 1994, the department has been doing the same, developing a lot of policies and programs to try to level these playing fields. Also developing policies to try to bring into the center of the economy policies, incentives, not necessarily really guided by one umbrella policy. But 2005, 2006, the department started developing a policy that will really guide not only the Department of Trade and Industry, but other departments that play a role in promoting industry and progress in the economy. So we have already presented the policy to this committee, but we thought it's prudent that from time to time we come back and report the implementation of this policy. There are many problems that we are facing. Programs is still a very new program. Some of these problems are even interdepartmental, because we are still trying really very hard, and all the departments are trying to work in cluster form, as you know. By the time different mandates cross each other, and we are working hard on trying to smooth the way between the work of all the departments. But then really, as my colleagues will present, there are areas where we also need the support of this committee in trying to solve some of the problems that we have. We know that Mr. Chairperson, using the influence of this committee, that we can also assist the department in its effort to implement these action plans that have tight schedules that we put for ourselves and time frame. So without wasting any time, I'll let Mr. Zalk and Mr. Madula to do the presentation and send it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair, honorable members. I think it might be useful just to remind the committee of the the thrust of the Industrial Policy Action Plan that we presented last time to the committee, and that was approved by Cabinet in August of last year. And that is really the an identification of four lead sectors: metal fabrication, capital and transport equipment, autos and components, chemicals, plastic fabrication, pharmaceuticals, forestry, pulp and paper, and furniture, the stabilization of the clothing and textile industries, as well as maintaining progress on the CISA key sector priorities. And then some key cross-cutting actions, two really being scaling up industrial financing and upgrading support, as well as measures to reduce input costs on intermediate inputs into manufacturing in particular. And it's a fairly detailed presentation, but I think our overall assessment is that, notwithstanding very challenging global and domestic conditions, manufacturing has remained quite robust. we've generally the progress of implementing the industrial policy action plan has been good, and we've seen very significant progress, in particular, we think that we need to scale up work around the metal fabrication, capital and transport equipment area. We're well on track now to announce and to finalise and announce the revised programme for the automotive sector. We want to indicate to the committee some of our new thinking on how we intend to support the stabilisation of the clothing and textile sector. But in general, we think progress has been very good. There have been some challenges, as my colleague has indicated, and a number of those are intergovernmental in nature. And we'll touch on that as we go through the presentation. This really shows quarterly manufacturing output performance since the beginning of 2000. And what we've seen is, as I said, a very resilient and growing manufacturing sector, which has grown steadily since 2000. Obviously, this more recently sector was affected by the power outages that we experienced in January of this year. And one will see that generally in the first quarter of a year, there is a decline in output relative to the last quarter of the previous year. But what we've seen is that decline is not really, it's slightly bigger than perhaps the last couple of years, but it's not really a huge decline which is out of sync with what's happened in previous years. So hence the belief that we have a very resilient manufacturing sector. If one looks at the growth in the year-on-year growth in the first quarter of this year, in comparison with the first quarter of last year, not a very high growth rate, 1.5%. As I say, this quarter is generally slower than other quarters, but certainly positive, resilient growth of output in the sector. And we've seen strong growth in a number of sectors, unsurprisingly batteries and a range of areas related to electricity, chemicals. I won't go through this in detail because we're actually going to go in detail through each of the main sectors in the course of the presentation. Turning then to the first of the lead sectors, which is metal fabrication, capital and transport equipment. This sector was identified, set of industries was identified, largely because the public expenditure program that's taking place in electricity and in transport and resuscitating that infrastructure really gives us an opportunity to resuscitate this part of manufacturing in the first instance, and then to put them on a platform for export growth in the future, and hence we believe it's absolutely critical that we have coordinated efforts around supporting the resuscitation of these sectors. The performance has been quite good, although we believe that it can be really substantially strengthened. In terms of the actions that were identified, removal of import duties on key industrial inputs, lowering or removal of duties, the duties on carbon and stainless steel, import duties on carbon and stainless steel have been removed some time ago. There's currently a review underway on duties on certain aluminium products, and that process will be finalized in June of this year. One of the key drivers of this program are the supplier development program, which are developed by the state-owned enterprises themselves under the umbrella of Department of Public Enterprises Competitive Supply Development Program. And clearly we've seen improved performance of these sectors in response to the growing infrastructure investment in the country. However, we really believe that this can be substantially strengthened even further. And in that respect, Transnet and Eskom have presented to us and to industry their first draft of their supply development program. Our feeling at DTI is that although we're encouraged by some of the work that's been done, we really think that those supply development programs need to be strengthened. In many cases, we feel that what is being set out is rather an approach to supply development as opposed to actual very concrete supply development plans. So we believe that's the one area where, as we indicated, where this role of intergovernmental coordination is going to be so important is for us to work with DPE and with the state-owned enterprises to ensure that those supply development plans are strengthened and that they really deliver tangible results in the economy. And I suppose one of our worries is that in the midst of this energy crisis that we find ourselves in, that perhaps there might be a temptation to take the eye off the ball of the supply development side of the industry, and we really want to urge that doesn't take place, and if we give very firm attention to this matter of supply development. Then the National Tooling Initiative was launched in March of this year. This is really aimed at resuscitating tooling capacity in the country. Tooling is really the center of manufacturing. It's the dies and the molds that are used to actually make manufactured products, and a lot of tools, machine tools we import. So it's critical that we resuscitate this part of the industry, and that's why it's very significant that this was launched in March of this year. Similarly, foundries, which is the casting of products, is also an industry that has been in decline, and it's a very central support industry to the rest of manufacturing, and hence the formation of the National Foundry Technology Network with pilot projects that will commence in July of this year. One of the constraints that we've raised with respect to, in fact, to our whole industrialization drive has been the pricing and availability of steel, and particularly carbon steel. And on many occasions we've raised the matter of pricing of carbon steel. We have some further detail in the appendix 2 of this presentation where we are concerned about price, but we are also concerned about lack of investment in the carbon steel sector. We've actually seen the production of liquid steel decline in South Africa between 2004 and 2007, notwithstanding this large infrastructure construction investment that's happening in the country. And that's a matter of considerable concern to us. And hence, in the action plan, we said, look, we need to examine the feasibility of trying to attract possible new carbon steel investments into South Africa, partly to introduce competition into the market because of the pricing concerns, but also, I think, to increase security of supply in the carbon steel sector. This work is underway at the moment, I think it's premature to report on this now. It's a very complex area of work, which also includes, some commercial sensitivities in terms of, companies that we've had discussions with. So we want to take recommendations to our minister in July from the work of this task team, for further consideration. Then, so far there's been a focus on supplier development in relation to the public infrastructure around electricity and around freight transport. But we also believe that there are very serious industrial policy opportunities arising out of our broader public transport policy, emerging public transport policy, especially around commuter rail. And in fact, that there are synergies between the two. So, for instance, if you know, Transnet is purchasing wagons for its freight rail side, and then at the same time one is getting commuter rail purchases, that raises a broader set of opportunities to manufacture these products in South Africa. So one of the areas I think that's going forward is really to develop a proper industrial policy response to the broader public transport policy. And then turning to the economic performance, I think what we've seen since 2003 is a strong uptick, particularly in the metal product sector, with a bit of a leveling in 2006 in the machinery and equipment sector, and to a lesser extent in the transport equipment sector. And I think that indicates the kind of impact that the public expenditure program is having on the manufacturing sector. But we would ideally, we think that this growth in these sectors should be higher, that we really should be leveraging this much more strongly. Also, the relatively flat growth in the transport equipment area perhaps is an indication that the transport side of the public expenditure program is not progressing as rapidly as it should be. On the employment front, then, I think what we've seen then is an uptick in employment in the metal products and machinery and equipment area, with employment remaining fairly stable in the transport equipment area.
I forgot to bring my microscope. Can't read that page.
It was difficult, though, didn't it?
I apologize. We'll ask them for criteria to you. So as you're balancing the interests of the environment.
Get it right.
Maybe we haven't got the balance quite right. Turning then to the automotive and components sector, this has really been the cornerstone of post-apartheid industrial policy. It's the motor industry development program. We believe that the process, which at a time was somewhat stalled, is now very firmly on track to deliver a revised, and essentially an announcement on the architecture of the new program in August of 2008. In that respect, if I could just indicate that we apologize, we picked up an error in the which exists in the printed copy of the presentation, which says that legislation will be finalized in September of this year. That is incorrect. The architecture of the program will be announced in August of this year, with legislation then to follow as rapidly as possible thereafter. So essentially where we are at the moment is there's an intergovernmental task team which has developed a draft architecture of the program, and that will be tabled in June of this year with stakeholders, obviously the industry, labor, and other stakeholders for comment in June of this year, so that there's adequate time for them to comment in order for the finalization of the architecture by August of this year. A very important component of the strategy going forward is to deepen the component sector of the automotive industry. This is where we believe that a lot of the value added on the job are going to come from is by deepening that component sector of the industry, and hence our first step towards that is the relaunch of the 2-year supply development program, starting off with the quality management system component that has been rolling out since September 2007, and we will be rolling out other modules of the program commencing later in this year in conjunction with technical support from the United Nations Industrial Development Organization. There will also be the formulation of an empowerment plan for the sector, and that work is to be completed by December of this year. I think this really slide gives a picture of the progress in the automotive sector since 1994. Very steady and fairly rapid growth in the sector. What we've seen is a growth. We're now at about 600,000 units per annum in the sector, and between 95 and last year, exports in the sector grew essentially exponentially, about tenfold. So this really is a key sector in the economy, and hence government's indication that we will continue to provide support in the sector, but it has to become more intelligent. It has to be more focused on driving value added, on developing the component sector more strongly. So that's the trajectory going forward, with the target of reaching 1.2 million units by 2020. Employment in the sector, we've always said that the automotive sector, although employment has grown in the sector narrowly defined, that the main purpose from an employment point of view has always been to stabilize employment in the sector, and we believe the program has been incredibly successful in this regard. But there has been a steady increase in employment from about 110,000 people to about 130,000 people. There was a down tick in 2007. But what we also believe is very, very important about the sector is the linkages and the employment effect that it has on other sectors. So this is a sector that demands inputs from a whole range of other sectors: steel, plastics, leather, even platinum. So the broader multiplier and linkage effect that the sector has on the rest of the economy is absolutely critical. On the chemical, plastic, and pharmaceutical side, again, there's a review underway on the import duty on upstream chemical products, and this too is, we're informed by the International Trade Administration Commission that this work will be completed by June 2008. The program, there was an initiative to look at how we increase polypropylene value-added products used in automotive and packaging. For normal people, that means the actual plastic products that are used in autos and packaging. There was a study that was conducted under the auspices of Medlac, and that's been finalized, and the promotion of certain investment opportunities will commence in June of 2008. In general, I think we need to strengthen the work in this area and increase our focus on how we really strengthen, in particular, the plastics fabrication side of the industry. So I think there's probably further work, further strategy work that needs to happen in this area as we commence with the implementation of the existing actions identified in the IPAC. There's also a fluorochemical expansion initiative, which is a high-value beneficiation initiative. Here we've secured an investment commitment in this regard, but there's an outstanding issue of securing sufficient land for the project, which would still need to be resolved. We also indicated in the Industrial Policy Action Plan that we want to really want to leverage public procurement much more actively in a range of areas in order to promote domestic manufacturing. And one of the areas that we indicated is because of there's currently a very large tender for the procurement of antiretrovirals by the Department of Health, which will run for the next few years. This is one area where we've run into, this is one of the coordinate areas of coordination where we have run into difficulties we are a little concerned that the industrial policy considerations in this tender were not given adequate attention, and we did, in fact, we did a lot of work with the Industrial Development Corporation, indicating that, you know, the very large benefits that would stem to the domestic economy and even to the fiscus from ensuring or rather promoting that these much of the antiretrovirals are manufactured in South Africa. But there have been, let's say, challenges that we've run into in this process. So I think what we're going to do is give an honest assessment, I think, of where we've run into challenges of this nature as we go through this presentation, so we can alert the committee to these issues in the hope that the committee itself can exert some influence in this regard. The progress in the sector also, we've seen steady growth, somewhat flatter around 2000 and 2007. Still some steady growth in the different areas of the sector: basic chemicals, other chemicals, as well as plastic products. As I've indicated, that visible, but here we really believe that there's a lot of opportunity to promote these plastic products, which is a much more labour intensive side of the industry, and we really would want to see that trending upwards with the growth of the sector. So we think that's an important issue for us going forward. On the employment front, we've seen I suppose an overall trend decline in the basic chemical side of the industry. That's obviously the very capital intensive, as well as other chemicals that kind of dipped in recovery by 2007, and also a moderate decline in employment in the plastic fabrication, and that's a matter of concern to us. And this is really we need to strengthen our interventions. Then the fourth sector, or the cluster of sectors, is wood, paper, pulp and furniture. This was identified because this really, we believe, has this is a sector that operates, not in the normal traditional industrial heartland, although part of it does, but this is a sector that really can have an impact on poorer rural areas in the Eastern Cape and also in KwaZulu-Natal. The key issue here really in the promotion of the growth of the sector is in the issuing of water licenses, and obviously that needs to be balanced with, the matter of water, water availability and so on. But there is an agreement that's been struck with Department of Water Affairs and Forestry that we will look at scaling up really the hectares that are afforested. In the first instance, in the Eastern Cape, 3,000 hectares, and this year 8,000 in 2009, and then 10 hectares per year thereafter in the Eastern Cape, and I think and then more detailed plans for that scaling up in KwaZulu-Natal are still being finalised, and I think obviously this is where we'll come back and report back to the committee on an ongoing basis on some progress. Then also identified the need for skills transfer program to upgrade small sawmillers, and this is really kicking off with a pilot project in the Kripani municipality where the service provider for that project has been approved. And then the expansion of the furniture industry. There has been the kickoff of a furniture incubator in Mpasa, which will start operating in November of this year. But I think we also recognize that we need a deeper response to the furniture industry, because this again is another fairly labor-intensive sector, and hence there's a draft furniture strategy which has been completed, and in due course I think we'll bring the put out the strategies and associated action plans into the public domain. On the growth side, very good growth in wood and wood products, with also moderate growth in paper and paper products have shown very good growth, moderate growth in wood and wood products and furniture. On the employment front, less of a positive picture, some moderate employment decline in the wood and wood product area, more so in the paper and paper products, obviously an indication that the sector is becoming more capital intensive. And then furniture, fairly flat employment, but then with an uptick in 2007. Obviously a sector which is a huge concern in the South African economy is the clothing and textile sector. And this is a sector really that I think, first of all, one you need to contextualize. This is a sector that globally is under massive competitive pressure. So I think the challenges that we're facing in South Africa are not unique. Almost every other country, with the exception of the few countries that are really taking up very large market share, global market share in this industry, like China, India, and to a lesser extent, say Bangladesh, and so on. I think just about every country is facing challenges in this industry. Now, one response, that's been articulated is to say, well, why should we be in this industry? Let this industry die, and we should focus on other things. And it's not clear what those other things should be. Nobody's ever indicated what those other industries should be. But we feel very passionately as a department that the industry has it employs a number of people. It's a very important employer in the economy. It has built up capabilities which we would be foolish to abandon. And we firmly believe that the sector can be stabilized. If we're realistic, I think I don't think we can honestly say that we believe this is going to be a major area of growth in employment, but we need to stabilize the sector, we need to stabilize employment in the sector, and for that reason we're reporting on progress on the ICAP, but what we also want to indicate is it's some of our thinking going forward about how we do that. So in terms of the actions that have already been identified, the first four measures to recapture and stabilize the domestic market, the country of origin labeling initiative has been in place since July. We've also had the quotas, or perhaps more correctly, voluntary restraint from the Chinese on certain, and not all, clothing and textile products in place since January of 2007, and that has had an important influence on giving the industry some breathing space. But I think we have to be emphatic and say that although we believe that the quotas have been important, that in itself is not an adequate response to the industry. And come to that in a moment. What we also have started to do is look at the import duties and inputs into the clothing sector. And there's common agreement in the sector across both the clothing and the textile players that there are certain fabrics that are not produced in South Africa and that are not produced in sufficient commercial quantities, that it makes no sense for those fabrics to attract an import duty, and that it raises the cost structure of the clothing sector, and hence this review. And that will be completed by August of this year. To give the industry further breathing space, the interim textile and clothing development program, which was formerly known as the duty credit certificate scheme, has been extended until March of 2009, with limited tradability. Limited tradability means that people will earn duty credits for exporting, but those credits cannot be sold to anybody. They can only be sold within the manufacturing sector itself. And that's important because then one avoids the leakage, let's say, of these duty credits to the retail sector, where one would actually then have these credits encouraging further import. There's also been the establishment of a textile engineering center of excellence in Port Elizabeth. But going forward, we there's six areas in which we will move rapidly and have already done a substantial amount of work in stabilizing the clothing and textile sector. The first and this has already been said, is that we need a replacement scheme for the interim textile and clothing development program. This has been said for a long time, and we need it in place by March of 2009, which is when the program expires. And we believe, our initial thinking in this regard is that it should be replaced with some kind of productivity-based incentive scheme, which is trade-neutral. In other words, it doesn't make a distinction whether you export or whether you produce for the local market. And we think that's very important because we've seen very large import penetration into the sector. And the key challenge really is to recapture domestic market share. And hence the need for a support mechanism that effectively rewards productivity upgrading in the sector, which is the direction that we believe the sector has to go. We increasingly need to upgrade the capability and the productivity levels of the sector because we cannot compete. Certainly, we cannot compete on kind of low wages against the low wages and high social wages that prevail in countries like China. So we need to position ourselves differently globally in this industry. That in turn will be supported by support for capital and technology upgrading. Now, we are going to announce an enterprise growth program, which is the program that will replace what was the Small and Medium Enterprise Development Program. Within the ambit of that program, we anticipate that we've made provision for capital and technology upgrading in that program basically open to any manufacturing industry, but in the anticipation that there will be a couple of key industries that that will require this, that will need to invest in capital and technology upgrading. One is going to be the clothing and textile industry. Another is going to be in the areas of capital equipment, transport equipment, and metals, and probably a range of other areas. We're also working with Industrial Development Corporation to look at some kind of dedicated investment support, probably in the form of some kind of loan scheme, also to further support this capital and technology upgrade. Thirdly, we want to much more aggressively tackle illegal imports through the establishment of a dedicated interdepartmental illegal import task team, particularly tackle the issues of smuggling and under-invoicing, which we believe are fully right in this industry. Number four, or the fourth area, is an upscaling of skills in conjunction with the clothing textile, footwear and leather sector. And we've been engaging with that sector to look at ways in which we can upscale their programs. This is a sector that's actually been performing very well in the broader sector system, and we believe that they have the capability to really work in conjunction with us to drive the skills upgrade. Fifthly, we need to systematically review input costs along the value chain, and this might require some hard choices. We understand that 50% of the cost of producing a garment is the input cost of the fabric itself. So I think we're going to have to make some hard choices about, how do we deal with that? And that might require some kind of review to the tariff regime on textiles. But I think that what's critical is the sequencing of this program. So we don't believe that we should be reviewing the tariffs on textiles until we have this productivity, capital, and technology upgrade support in place to allow that side, which is the more capital-intensive side of the industry, to adapt. And then lastly, and I think that elements 1 through 5, we can largely complete by March of next year, although the review of input costs is going to take somewhat longer. I think a more medium-term program then is the development of much stronger innovation and technology support for the sector, with a whole range of elements which I can elaborate on perhaps later if members would like. But really, so the direction for the industry is absolutely clear. Productivity upgrading, skills development, this is the direction that the industry has to move in order to stabilize, and we need to put substantial support behind that. If we look at the performance of the sector from a growth point of view, on the apparel side, we've seen some moderate growth since 2003. Textiles there was a decline between 2004 and 2006, with then some recovery in 2007. I think everybody knows the employment story in this industry, from around 105,000 employed in 1994 and many more prior to that, down to around 70,000 in the textile industry in 2007. On the in the clothing industry, on the textile side, also a decline, steady decline since 1994, but with a stabilization in 2006 and 2007. And I think what's critical then is to similarly achieve stabilization in the clothing side of the industry. Just looking then at imports into the South Africa, I mean, what we've seen is a large growth in imports, and over the last few years, increasingly from China. And although these kind of quarterly figures, there's a lot of variation in them. I mean, I think what's clear is that, one was getting almost exponential growth rates of imports, and I think that's why it became essential to act, and essentially securing voluntary commitment from the Chinese. It's difficult over what's been a relatively short period to fully assess the impact of the quotas, but we believe that it has brought down levels of imports, certainly from their peaks. And this is total imports, although China has a large share now in total imports. But on this, I mean, it clearly had a very strong effect on Chinese imports in the specific products in which these quotas prevail. It's been a matter of some contention. The decision still needs to be made. You know whether. And if so, for how long we may wish to continue with the quotas. That decision has not been made, whether or not to allow them. They end at the end of this year, that we still need to, I think, make what is quite a difficult decision on whether we should be extended. But I think our view is the quotas are perhaps a bit of a red herring. The key issue is a broad set of measures to stabilize the capabilities and employment in the industry. And I think we've indicated the kind of thinking that we have in this area. And that's what's absolutely critical for this industry going forward. Then to briefly report on, we focused on the sectors for which DTI has generally direct responsibility, but to report then on progress on some of the key areas beyond that. These are key sectors. Well, in fact, this is indeed an area that DTI has direct responsibility for as well. Business process outsourcing. Just some highlights here, I think, around these sectors. In terms of BPO, we've introduced a BPO incentive scheme that's being rolled out. We already have 9 projects approved, which will generate over 9,000 direct jobs, around 660 million rand in investment. We've attracted a major global BPO operator, Teletech, to South Africa, and I think that kind of the signal that sends is very important for our country when one attracts large kind of high profile investor in this regard. There's in terms of a special telecommunications pricing regime for these BPO operators. There is a preliminary agreement that has been reached with Telkom, but there's certain regulatory approvals that are necessary in order to give effect to that agreement. The Competition Commission needs to just essentially check that there are no competition concerns, so there's an exemption that's required there from the Competition Commission, and then ICASA also has to really give a stamp of approval to this deal. So there's certain, there's been a bit of delay in this area because there's certain regulatory issues that need to be ironed out. In terms of the training side, which is also critical, the Monyetla Work Readiness Program, funds have been committed to train 6,400 learners, but the overall aim is to train about 30,000 learners over the next 4 years. So I think, we've said this is an industry that can we can create a lot of jobs in this area, and I think the results of that are starting to come through the system now. The tourism side, I mean, this has been generally a major success story. I understand we were, I think, from figures released recently by Status A, whereas I think in the year before last, I think we were at about 8 million tourist arrivals. We now I think it's gone, according to Department of Affairs and Tourism, has gone up to in the order of 9 million. That's overall tourism arrivals from all destinations, including the rest of the continent. So it's a sector, I think, that's really performing well. Some of the key initiatives here, there's a customized tourism enterprise program, which is also a subcomponent of the small of the enterprise growth program, which is really aimed at growing smaller enterprises in the tourism arena, so that we really spread the gains from growth and change the structure of growth in this industry with the concomitant employment benefits that brings. Secondly, I mean, one constraint is the safety and security issue, and for that reason, national tourism safety and awareness strategies are being implemented now at provincial level, and also there's a revised tourism sector skills plan, which was launched recently. There are many actions in this area, but these are just some of the highlights. On the biofuel side, I mean, there's been, and again, I mean, this is really, I think, obviously a matter for a different portfolio committee, but, you know, obviously there's been massive debate around biofuels and its impact on various things, you know, particularly food security, food pricing. So I think, the update that we've received is being consultations with the biofuels industry, putative biofuels industry. I think the process now is one of really refining the strategy, presumably to take into account some of the evidence that's emerging globally about, you know, around biofuels, and that task team then will revert back to cabinet on this matter. One of the things that we indicated in the industrial policy framework and the action plan is, look, industrial policy needs tangible support. As a result, we as a department, have been working on firstly an enterprise growth program, and that will be launched in July of this year. And I've indicated some elements of that already. So it's essentially a program that will support small and medium enterprises, support investments in small and medium enterprises. What we've done, although it generally doesn't have a sector-specific focus, it does have certain modules which are sector-specific, but it's to anticipate the requirements of certain sectors in the economy. So, for instance, we anticipated that clothing and textiles, metals, machinery, etc., will need to upgrade the capital equipment. That often, one will be looking at expansion, say, metals, or technology upgrades in some of these areas rather than entirely new greenfield investments. So we've brought that thinking into the enterprise growth program. Then obviously a relatively recent development was the announcement by the Minister of Finance in his budget speech of a package of 5 billion tax incentives. Obviously we're in the process now of putting meat to those bones in conjunction with National Treasury, but we aim to then launch that package of tax incentives by December of 2008. In March of this year, there was a revised film incentive, film and television production incentive for foreign and local production, which was launched in March of this year. This is really, again, to promote further deepening of local production in the sector. And I think what it also indicates is the ability of the department to put a program in place, you know, have it running, assess it, revise it, you know, pick up when it needs adjustments and come back and make those adjustments. As I've indicated, there's been good progress with the BPO incentives, And then also at OR Tambo International Airport, it's anticipated that this will be designated as an industrial development zone in October of this year, also with an associated general manufacturing precinct. A number of times we've indicated that one of the we believe to growing manufacturing sector in particular is a range of anti-competitive behavior and outcomes in the market. And in particular, we believe that this takes place in a lot of areas where there are intermediate input into manufacturing. But, I mean, obviously this behavior has much broader impact on the South African economy. It has an impact on consumers, you know, through basic foodstuffs and in a whole range of areas. And in this respect, I think there's a couple of developments. I mean, the first is that we've identified the need to strengthen the Competition Act and make amendments to the Act to really strengthen this, competition policy for development in South Africa. I think what's also is very important, and I think we really need to applaud the competition authorities, is that they have become much more assertive in dealing with these matters than they have been in the past. I think we're seeing a strengthening of legislation, but even before that strengthening of legislation, I think we're really seeing a strengthening of implementation of competition policy. Now, there's a whole set of public hearings that are scheduled on this competition matter fairly soon in this portfolio committee. So, I don't think it's premature to go into huge detail on this matter. But suffice to say that we see this as a very important support measure for our industrial policy efforts, and also more broadly for ensuring that consumers have access to affordable products in the South African market. But the main element, really, I suppose, to highlight is the amendments, is to firstly to allow the Commission to undertake proactive market investigation, or more proactively undertake independent market investigation, and ensure transparency in the market in certain markets. Also, to obviously, because of the complexity of our regulatory regime, there are certain issues around concurrent jurisdiction that I think will be dealt with in this legislation, and also to give, I suppose, much stronger legal effect to the leniency program, which has been so effective in really dealing with cartel behavior, and to put that on a firmer legal basis in this legislation. Secondly, and we've already indicated this above, but our approach is really to review lower and possibly remove import duties on key intermediate inputs into manufacturing, unless there's a very strong case to show that those need to remain. And obviously in areas, where markets are relatively undistorted, so let's say unlike agriculture, where there's large surpluses of domestic production over demand. I think all of these things need to be taken into consideration. But essentially, where one has these very profitable, industries that in fact were the products of prior industrial policy, but they're infant industries that have grown up. So they need to be treated as adults, and probably no longer require protection from the state. Then I think really just to turn perhaps to some of the challenges. As I said, I think we've indicated that we've already, even though this IPAP has only been running since August of last year, I mean, we believe we've made very important progress on this, but there are constraints and there are challenges, and we want to indicate what these are to the committee. So obviously the broad macroeconomic conditions have often been unfavorable, particularly for the manufacturing sector. We have a concern about rising interest rates. I think currency volatility remains a big problem, although I think the issue of overvaluation, which prevailed periodically, is now less of a concern for us. I mean, the currency has adjusted, which is to be expected with the kind of large current account deficit that we've been running. Obviously, the electricity situation needs to be dealt with very strategically in order to ensure that it doesn't become a constraint on our industrial policy program. And that really means a much more strategic approach to, in particular, the allocation of electricity and, so basically who gets new electricity connections. And this is a matter that I think hasn't received sufficient attention, but we would argue very strongly that in the light of a national industrial policy program, that there should be priority given to our industrial policy imperatives when these types of issues come up. So I think that's one of a number of issues. But I think there are others which I'll touch on a bit later. Then there are a number of intergovernmental coordination issues. The first is a financing issue. Now, I mean, one issue is a matter of the quantum of financing. You know, is there sufficient financing being behind such a program? I think that's an important issue. I think it's interesting to appraise the committee when we talk about the kind of quantum of financing that's needed. I mean, I think we need to bear in mind what are other countries, what are our industrial competitors and comparable countries providing, and what is quite significant is that last week, and I'm not sure how aware people are of this, Brazil launched its industrial policy, and I think that's it's a very significant thing. Unfortunately, we're constrained in our ability to read Portuguese, so we're waiting to try and get some English translation. From the press coverage around it, they're talking of kind of $12.7 billion in support for their program through to 2011, and also of possibly of the establishment of a sovereign wealth fund also to support this program. So I think, I think this international context is very important to take into consideration. So that's one matter, but I think that one area is the financing issue. Is constrained, there's a quantum constraint, but there's also there's a matter of securing financing. And I think one of the things that we really grapple with as a department is there's when we go to National Treasury and we say we believe Program X should receive finance, there's lack of clarity on what the required business case is. In other words, if one goes to the bank and says I want to start a business, the bank will say to you, this is the template that you must fill in. This is the business case you must answer to, these are the criteria you must meet, and then we will, on that basis we will say yes, we will lend you the money, or no, we won't. And I think one of the things that we really grapple with is, we don't know what the criteria are. We have no, the criteria are not clear. And I think that's something it's a very important issue, I think, that we need to pin down. Because otherwise we don't know what, we may have a sense of what we think is a good business case, But Treasury may disagree. And so I think as a practical matter, I think that's quite important for example, I mean, we've been trying to, just as an anecdotally, there's a program, a capacity building program, we're trying to get a budget line. We have been trying for 3 years to get a budget line for this program, and the money, the quantities involved are not large. It's not the quantum that's the issue. It's the backwards and forwards, and the massive inefficiencies and waste that is involved. And I think we correctly pride ourselves on as a government on efficiencies in the way that we manage our public finances. But I think there's a huge matter of efficiency here. Around this issue of the business case that needs to be addressed. Then, other areas where we've run into, intergovernmental coordination issues is around public procurement, where, we said in the industrial policy framework and in the action plan in relation to certain areas that there are often in relation to public procurement is a really compelling logic that says that you should try and procure as much as possible of a particular product in South Africa. And we're not suggesting that every product that's procured by government must be locally procured. But often there are very large industrial policy opportunities that arise. And if we don't take strategic advantage of them, then we lose out on as a country on employment, on security of supply, on a whole range of issues. So at a couple of these areas where this has come up is, I've already indicated around the antiretroviral, tender for antiretroviral. Another area where there's substantial confusion and where I don't think there's an adequate industrial policy response emerging is in the relationship to the digital migration strategy, which says that, look, we're going from analog signals, analog television signals to digital television signals. Over a period of 3 years, we'll be broadcasting both, and then the analog will be switched off. And in that period, we need to move to, everybody to have digital access, which means they must have set-top boxes. And there's a recognition that for low-income households, about 4.5 million low-income households, those have to be provided. One can't say, well, you must go out and just pay a market price in order to have access to a television signal. So that's got to be provided at some kind of in some concessional way by the state. Now that's a major manufacturing opportunity. It's also an opportunity to position ourselves to produce these things firstly for the local market, for the regional market and even more broadly. So again, this is another area I think we're running into some difficulties. The other area, and I think I've touched on this as well, is the competitive supply development programs of the state-owned enterprises. Although, yes, there's good work happening, it really needs to be strengthened. There's a whole lot more leverage you can get out of public expenditure programs in order to resuscitate very important parts of manufacturing, and there's an abiding logic to manufacturing a lot of these things in South Africa. Security of supply, if you don't want a situation where a power station is offline because the component has to be imported from somewhere, or where a train's not running, because it doesn't have the wagon wheels. So there's a compelling logic to having these things manufactured locally. And I think, just to be clear, we're not saying that this must be manufactured locally at any cost. They've got to be manufactured competitively. We're not saying to manufacturers, this is an opportunity to kind of raise your prices and kind of ripple the local market. But what we're saying is that if we can sequence coordinate, provide better information about the sequencing of investments, support the upgrading of their capabilities, then we can really get a major impact on the South African economy. Then there's some other specific issues. You know, there's a long outstanding matter of export tax on scrap metals. Almost every other country has, some countries prevent outright they ban the exportation of scrap because it's such an important input into a whole range of industries, foundries, and all sorts of industries, and it's an important kind of recycling process. Again, this is another area where we've been somewhat bogged down in, the legislation resides, I think, with National Treasury, and there's differences of opinion. There's perhaps a concern about opening the door to the use of export taxes more generally. So this is another area where this has come up. More broadly, what's critical for the industrial policy action plan really is the functioning of the other supporting systems. This whole skills development system, that needs to be well functioning. The transport system, I think I've already indicated, you need a supportive macroeconomic policy needs to be more integrated with the imperatives of the real economy. And this is a huge and contentious debate, but we cannot pretend that these things are not integrated with each other. The matter of monopolistic pricing of inputs remains a problem, and this is a cross-cutting problem. We've indicated this in Appendix 2. Just to give us, I think, a sense of the nature of the problem. If one looks at this is what we call the global cost curve. So what all of these bars are different plants around the world, steel plants around the world, and when you take them from low cost to high cost, we call it the global cost curve for the production of carbon steel, and in this case, hot rolled coil. What we see is that, the two major South African plants, at Sandouville and Saldanha, are really in the lowest decile, sorry, in the lowest quartile of the global cost curve. So we have a huge advantage in South Africa in the production of steel. Now, notwithstanding that, and notwithstanding very high prices, what is a matter of significant concern to us is that this is the liquid steel production of ArcelorMittal operations in South Africa between 2004 and 2007. This is from the annual report. This is in the public domain. So what we see is that, notwithstanding this incredibly beneficial global environment, commodity prices have been rising. Incredibly beneficial local environment, investments in construction, infrastructure, all sorts of steel-intensive demand. Carbon steel production has actually gone down. To us, this is an astonishing matter. That in such an advantageous environment, one would actually have decline in the production of steel in this market. And furthermore, although this is the production, these purple bars or the dark kind of reddish bars are the production of what they call long steel products. This is products, bars and sections and whatever that are largely used in construction. ArcelorMittal has about 50% global domestic market share. The other manufacturers in this area, so there's some competition. And here production has stayed more or less constant, even though one would expect it to go up. It's on the flat product side where there's the real very strong domestic market share. Approaching the order of 90% domestic market share. That production has actually gone down in a highly beneficial global and local environment. So And you have an ongoing, this ongoing and outstanding matter of pricing, with Arsenal Mittal. Now, what we've seen is that, and this is the pricing of hot rolled products for some time. We think that over certain periods and certain periods last year, we actually felt, okay, we're being hurt. There's some restraint in pricing in the South African market. Even though we haven't reached a formal agreement, there's been some kind of restraint going on. What we've seen though is, and yes, there have been very large global increases in prices, but we've now seen, whereas if one benchmarks pricing here against other countries, we've seen it more or less in the region of the world average. Now we see prices shooting up again, obviously in absolute terms, but also in relative terms as well, going again to the highest in the world. So you have a combination of lowest production costs in the world, highest prices in the world, and yet steel production not going up. This is a very, very concerning matter to us. And we don't presume to answer that, but it does raise competition concerns for us. I think that should be very clear. Going back then, lastly then, look, I think the other area of challenge to us, and I think this is obviously still squarely in our own court, and we need to address this, and it's the problem, is the ongoing matter of capacity. I think we are steadily building capacity, we're recruiting more people, particularly in the area of sector work. This is not progressing as quickly, and probably not getting as many people in posts as we would like. But this is an ongoing matter, I think, where we need to keep strengthening our capacity in order to implement this work. Then, lastly, I think what I would like to do is ask my colleague, Nkosi Madula, who's been working very intensively on this, is to talk a little bit about how we want to keep strengthening the industrial policy action plan process going forward. And then perhaps what I would like to do lastly is just touch on some of the issues related to industrial policy and how that links to the kind of electricity crisis that we face right now.
Thank you, Mr. Madula. Welcome to you also. I missed your name the first round.
Okay, thanks, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Mine is going to be a very brief presentation. As my colleague has indicated, we are trying to strengthen the IPAP process going forward. As we are all aware that the IPAP we are reporting on today was an annual program, but we want to change that to a three-year program. The main reason really is that of fostering alignment with the government program of action, as well as the medium-term expenditure framework. The medium-term expenditure framework, because we want all those key action plans which will appear on the industrial policy action plan to be aligned with the budget. It's no use to have proposed key action plans which are not budgeted for. But secondly, alignment with POA, we want to align this with the government program of action. So that there is no competition of responsibilities. In fact, we are trying to utilize the industrial policy action plan as a source of POA contributions by the industrial strategy focus group of the economic cluster. This process, therefore, is going to start around August every year, so that it starts just before the POA process by the other cluster, by the other focus groups of the economic cluster starts. Strengthening the quality and scale of industrial policy intervention is the main objective, really. As my colleague Nimrod has alluded just now, the electricity challenge we are faced with and our response to it thereof offer huge industrial policy opportunities, which this strengthening of IPAC is going to assist us leverage on them. They are in the areas of rolling out of the solar water heating and other energy efficient devices, in the form of promoting more electricity efficient industries, which are mainly in relatively more labor intensive industries. As well as basically industrial policy opportunities also exist in technology potential of renewable electricity generation in the form of solar heating examples as mentioned earlier on, in the form of promoting the energy efficiency of the existing industry, as well as in the alignment of our industrial policy activity with the need to deal with the global climate change. Thank you. That would be the end of my presentation.
Yeah, thanks very much. The chairperson has just gone off quickly. Oh, yeah, he's there. I don't know whether there is any other presentation about the last presentation.
No, thank you, Chair. That brings us to the end of the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks very much. Well, Chair, that is our presentation. But I forgot to mention one thing. The Director General of the Department has asked me to apologize on his behalf. He couldn't be here because of other urgent issues he has to attend to. But anyway, that's a presentation. I just want to emphasize that we will be taking questions from the honorable members. If we can't answer maybe questions that have specific answers needed from us, we will come back to the committee. But then we want to go back with some suggestions from the committee on the problems that we have raised here today. As you can see, there are a lot of challenges that we are facing, and really it's not about bashing up at the government department, but it's all about, as a government, if we say the industrial policy is a major problem of the whole of government, then how do we work together to implement it successfully? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been an exhaustive overview. I've noted you, Dr. Rabi, Mayor Amidu, Comrade Farida, Mr. Labas Kashmi,
You look too much alone.
And Mr. Hasmi and Dr. Rabi. And Professor Chen. Dr. Rabi.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairman. First and foremost, I think the textile industry, I think the submission by Mr. Zop there
shows how vulnerable this particular industry is, and I'm talking specifically about the Western Cape, the Greater Cape Town area. I think the shrinkage in the number of people being employed by this particular industry is cause for great concern. And secondly, I think I would like to sort of congratulate you on your honesty that when you stated that the quota system imposed on Chinese textiles was not a success. Because I mean, there were a number of repercussions, which I think is only feeding through to success now. So I think that is especially something which is very good. And the second thing is, I've spoken to quite a number of manufacturers, and they say that the degree or the number of grey or illegal imports into this country is of great concern. I know you're not the customs, you're not the department and so forth, but I think we'll have to do something about that. And then the other aspect, Chairman, I think the biofuel industry is extremely important because this is also a source of employment, especially to small-scale farmers. If we can get this off the ground, we can solve a fair number of our social problems. And then thirdly, I think what the government should really do, Chairman, is that we should really look at the question of scrap copper, because it's costing the taxpayer and the ratepayers millions and millions of rand in this particular day and time. And I think the sooner we stop this, the better. I don't think we should ban all other metals, scrap metals, because it also provides employment, especially smaller people. But the degree which the copper scrap has been taken from institutions such as ESCOM and local authorities is really, I think, we cannot afford this, and I think we need to take proactive steps regarding that. Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Ravi, thank you. Mayor, with you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I must also thank the presenter for their presentation. I also want to agree with you that industrial policy is a major policy from which most of the policies really stem and base their policies. Therefore, it is an important policy. I thought perhaps you were going to share with us as to what the progress does make in terms of the quota systems that were introduced, and not just to say that, you know, they are not working, but I think it is important to share with us as to why are these quotas not working. And also, I think my colleague has also highlighted the problem of illegal, you know, imports that are really flooding our country. And I think it's important that we also come up with some form of protection. I heard you during your presentation saying that, you know, yes, I agree, some of the industries are no longer intense, but I think even those well-developed countries still have control by way of, you know, imposing tariffs to protect the infant industry. I also have a concern about the difficulty in this interdepartmental, you know, coordination, because that has been a major problem for us. And I think we are wasting a lot of resources by not being able to do that, whereby we duplicate resources. And when one looks at the policies, it's vital that we have that type of exercise, you know, taking place, so that we can be able also, you know, to not to outstretch Department of Trade and Industry. Because when I was listening to you talking about the antiretroviral, then I asked myself, I wonder to what extent have you been able to interact with health, because that area also belongs to health, and a number of other areas, you know, whereby I think there has to be that type of interaction. And then I also heard you talking about whereby you highlighted on page 8, you talked about skill transfer program to upgrade the technological equipment for small formula. I hope couples with that will have a mechanism of monitoring, because whilst on one hand we are talking of lack of skills, lack of capacity, which we have been, you know, preaching ever since we came into this government, I wonder how much, you know, a time is spent, or what type of mechanisms do we have to ensure that these things take place, because they're very important. If we don't have any mechanisms to monitor skill transfer, we'll forever be talking about skills. We'll forever be talking about capacity. And I think we should actually tighten that area. Maybe I should stop here.
Thank you,
Madam.
Okay, I also want to add a few things. You know, in terms of the first slide, I think the manufacturing output, you've actually given us quite a bit of detail with regard to the figures. I actually looked at your negative figures, okay? I need to know, in terms of the motor car, automotive industry, it's minus 16.7. I just wanted to give you a little bit of information with regard to that, because from what I got is that our automotive industry is thriving. So perhaps we could just reconcile those figures for me. I want us to maybe apply our mind. I think I want to add my voice to my comrade that just spoke, because sometimes repetition is good. But I want to say that, you know, in terms of this negative figures, where we're falling short of, I think you've mentioned lack of capacity, competition, financing, challenges, skills, all those are challenges. That's why we're in this place. I call this the red area. But I want you to please take note that you talked about tightening the competition policy bill. Maybe if you could give us details, maybe not now but later, as to what would you like to change there to ensure that these figures now come to the positive. I think you also talked about infrastructure, and we do believe that that is a challenge. I want to talk about, once again, your coordination with departments. I think in terms of your coordination with departments, in terms of agriculture, science and technology, communication, because all that is falls into this paradigm. And I don't see the IT sector here. I don't know if I'm not looking correctly, but I don't see it there. Perhaps you could tell me a little bit on that. In terms of your graphs, I just want to go to page 9. And I want to talk about the paper and paper production, I think, or the products. Why is it on the decline? Because I see the sectoral value added is climbing, but the jobs are declining. So I don't know. Maybe if you could tell me a little bit on that. And then in the other graph here, I think we got this. Okay, I think I lost it. But anyway, let me just say, in terms of the rollout of the solar water heating system, I think that is something that is an opportunity. But perhaps if you could tell us how exactly are you looking at that sector? Because I do believe that we do have lack of capacity and skill. Perhaps if you can tell us exactly how you're going to fast track that in terms of working with the line function department, because I think it falls in a certain department. So perhaps you could just tell us a bit more on that. I think I found this other one here. Yeah, I want to say that the jobs in terms of, sorry, I have a little bit of a problem with my glasses. Yeah, it's basic chemicals. You also in terms of the sectoral employment. In terms of the sectoral employment of that, of the basic chemicals, because it's going down. So somehow I need a little bit of explanation with that. Thank you so much.
I have to go to the
application.
I need to take some
leave to do that. Man, you can't see the wood for the trees with all that paper. No, I didn't actually have my hand up. I look too much like him.
Oh.
He thinks, yeah. I declined that one.
I'm not sure if that's good
gentleman. I've got more hair. Unfortunately,
okay.
I have to leave, Mr. Chen. I don't want to ask a question and not be here for the answer.
Okay.
Chair, it was an excellent presentation. Thank you very much indeed. It really was first rate. I've got so many points. Let me be just very precise, because otherwise I'll go on forever. One is always looking at when your action plan, how does it relate to the original strategic document? Because when you presented both, or at least the DG did, we pointed out that there was a mismatch. And so we're always checking you that your action plan is in line with your strategy, because otherwise you're going off at a tangent. Two, I live in Cape Town. When you talk about the clothing industry, this is the rock bed of the social fabric of Cape Town. So when people come and talk to us about competitiveness and imports and all that, you're going to destroy the colored people of the Cape. If you don't take account, it's not only a matter of incomes and jobs. It's a matter of the whole traditions of the society. Whole families depend on this industry. And why are we so concerned with the imports and being competitive and global environment? We destroy our society. It's as simple as that. I live here, and there are tens of thousands of people, hundreds, in Cape Town, who have been trained and brought up in families where the clothing industry is the bedrock of their survival. I really find it very boring when you come and talk, well, not you, but people come and talk about a need to be globally competitive. I look at my neighbors in Cape Town. So, please, let's take account of that side of it. So, the key is, as you rightly said, market share of the domestic economy. These people depend on the domestic economy. And I can't stand it when some of our previous ministers of trade and industry, I won't name them, kept on talking about the need to be competitive and thereby destroying our local communities. It's not right. It's wrong. Absolutely wrong. So then there is the same the related point. Do we go for cheap goods or do we go for jobs? There's a trade-off. If you allow cheap goods for consumers, you destroy jobs. There's a trade-off. And we must, as a society, make... Look at our environment today, the xenophobia and all that. Surely it's related to the question of the job structure of the South African economy. No question. They're fighting for scarce resources. So, there's a trade-off between cheap goods for consumers. I'm sorry to say this, but Alec Irvin has always came to this committee and said we must lower the cost for consumers. Yes, and destroy jobs in the process. It's wrong. So there's a trade-off. We must get the balance right. I'm not saying you lean altogether one way, but to get the balance right. Four, upgrade our productivity, of course. And indeed, the emphasis on upgrading productivity is vital. But again, you have to look at the balance of jobs. You can't upgrade your productivity in a way which undermines your next objective, which is labor-intensive industrialization. And you've got both in your paper. So let's set out our principles more clearly. I it was an excellent presentation, thank you, and I'm not trying to destroy it. But we need to be clear. Is our priority productivity, or is our priority jobs, labor-intensive industry? You can't have both. Or if you do have both, you must have a very clear strategy which says, in this area we upgrade productivity, in that area we have labor-intensive. You can't talk about both in the generality and think you can get away with the plan. The macro. I disagree with the Treasury statement yesterday that we need fiscal discipline and we need austerity budgeting and we need a budget surplus. I disagree with that. And what you've told us clearly shows that that's a mistaken position, and I would urge this committee to say something about that. It's wrong. Because we followed 14 years of austerity budgeting and fiscal discipline, and look where we are in terms of poverty, unemployment, and income inequality. We are world record leaders on inequality. I think we're at the top. If you look at The Economist, we are double unemployment. Our figure for unemployment is double to the next category in the London Economist. So we are the world's worst in the London Economist. I'm not talking about speculation by some NGO. This is The Economist, which says we are 24% and the next one is 11. So look at the scale and the last page of The Economist, that's the situation. So let's be clear on where we are 14 years into democracy. Electricity, priority to industry, of course. This is where the East Asian Tigers were so strong. They identified industries which are going to grow the industrialization. Here is an opportunity. If we do not strengthen our domestic industry and manufacturing, when are we going to do it? So, the question of financing. Now, I hear your plea for more finance. But I must say, I'm not impressed with the way DTI manages its financing. I don't know that DTI could handle more money. And maybe the Treasury is cautious, because this is a problem we have in many departments, and I'm not certain. And I think maybe DTI should come and tell us, can you really manage more money? Because many departments can't. We don't want to go back to the rollover situation that we had 10 years ago. So if you want more money, tell us that you can handle it. Treasury, not clear on the criteria. Well, we've discussed this many times, and I think the committee should actually take a position, a proactive position, with the Treasury. Why is it that the DTI has trouble in getting through some of its programs because of confusion around policy? For me, I'm dead clear. DTI must progress, and we as a committee must give you full support in ensuring that the industrialization program of South Africa is not delayed by Treasury caution, by budget austerity, by all that stuff. There was a period when we had budget austerity in the early years, and people justified that because our domestic fundamentals were out of kilter. It's still arguable. I don't accept that whole case. I accept some of it. But now, we've got a budget surplus. We're supposed to be planning. The Minister of Finance says to us, let's discuss the three-year plan. Well, let's discuss it. And we will be with you on those questions very strongly. I think I've said more than enough just to say thank you very much. It's an excellent paper and full support from most of us, all of us, I'm sure.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. President. My first question relates to your page 15, slide number 25, biofuel. See, this issue, I think I would disagree with my colleague, Robbie, in terms of saying we must move fast on this. As much as saying that the biofuel task team is going to finalize the project, I think we should tread with caution here. It is not correct, not true, that this is going to assist the emerging farmers or the small scale farmers at all. I can tell you now at all. The reason behind this, I think you see now even the food crisis, it's also blamed on this particular issue. And I think also the Minister of Finance raised this issue when he was addressing the IMF and World Bank in Washington, D.C. I think it was last month.
we raise this issue sharply. But the question of the maize and soya beans and other issues, which are diverted to the biofuel instead of the foodstuff, is creating a killer problem. In fact, the most culprit is America, Europe, and other few countries. And I suppose that also Brazil is taking a lead in terms of biofuel. So, of course, they're ring fenced in terms of the production. I can really say this is a fallacy that is going to create more jobs. Instead, it's going to create serious problems in terms of the food security. The other issue, Chair, that I want to deal with is the question of your page 14 on slide number 28. I think my colleague has also dealt with the intra-governmental coordination. I think this question of clusters, I think also the presenter, when he was making some sort of a brief overview, you raised the question initially of the cluster and coordination. This is a serious problem. It's a serious problem because I always allocated this problem with the dysfunctionary process, so to speak. Because your DDs and DDGs, they always have to say, this is my test, this is my test, you know? And you end up having that problem instead of addressing particular issues. Even in terms of the food crisis, even now in terms of that cluster, the cluster don't talk in one job. You see the minister saying something else, you see another minister saying something else. Then where is the coordination in terms of this issue? This then takes me to the issue that you have raised in terms of your public procurement issues on digital sets. You know, you raise here a difficulty. The announcement has been made to raise your issue. That these digital sets are going to be implemented as November this year. And if you are still having some difficulties here, the announcement is made already that this is going to be rolled over, I mean, rolled immediately, then the issue that you have raised is low. The low income earner, that is going to be the problem. You should have foreseen this. This issue takes me in the next issue in terms of when the announcement was made about 2 years ago on the water and also the electricity, that they are going to have a certain amount for the poor. But when you link then the electricity with the energy sector, the announcement was made without your consent as an energy department. It took years before that kilowatt was given to the poor of the forest, the 50 kilowatts. Years. And Eskom was saying, we don't care, because not our duty to do that. This issue in terms of the against coordination, I don't understand in terms of that particular area. The other issue, Chair, that I want to give is on page 12. Page 12. Slide number 23. I think some of my colleagues have raised this issue. But I just want to take one issue here in relation to this trade issue. But it seems to me this trade between ourselves and China, it's more Chinese in Africa than South Africa in China. This is a vice versa. I don't know how and I don't know why. In each town in this country, you'll find that there are more than three Chinese shops in each town. I'm not saying each province, in each town, you know? And I don't know in terms of ourselves in that area, whether we are really making inroads in China, than the Chinese sort of coming, the whole Africa in terms is controlled by China today. For me, it's a serious question, because it doesn't make sense in terms of this trade that we are talking about. The last issue here is on page 4. Let's quickly go to page 4. The page 4, that is slide number 7, you raised an issue at the cap on steel investment. See, on this issue, I want to link to the question of the cost here. That the monitoring and trying to curb the cost of your steel, your fertilizer, and your cement and other related issues. But the cost is going up almost every day. I don't know whether this cap on steel investment is going to assist in terms, you refer to the competition, that when you have the competition, then you reduce the price. But in terms of the steel, I don't know, because if for you to produce some steel, I don't know whether it's for steel existing today, you know, in Perena, they used to have, I mean, that's what your massive production there. Because the problem here is that we always concentrate on import rather than creating our factory to make sure that we produce this thing here in the country. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just to say that the population of China
Many years ago, more than 15 years ago, I said that if they had stood hand, holding hands, they could go around the world more than 20 times. Now that was years ago. So today it's a different picture. You are definitely not going to compete, even if you have to take the whole of Africa to time. ESCOM. You'll have to look at your notes on Metal Steel. You swallowed your ESCOM. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I must commend the presenters for their very eloquent and focused presentation. In fact, we are happy that this committee, like Prof. Tirog has said, that you are doing this important job for the country. In fact, what we are doing, you are actually promoting industrialization in the country, which we need, which will actually create employment, which is a greater problem in the country. We have got this crisis today around Gauteng, precisely because of those issues. So we are very happy that you are working on this, and we just pray that this work must be uninterrupted, you know, by Treasury and those other bully girls and boys. But we need to say to the Department of Trade and Industry that it would seem that they've found some innovative ways of actually giving us the presentations, in that the more we grow in age, the less we should read in terms of the font. It's not the first time that we're getting this type of thing. I think we need to be empowered. The more we grow, we need to get more informed and see things clearly. It is not only Kombi Farida and others. All of us, the majority, we don't see some other things, especially the figures. It's a fine print. I'll go through these slides and ask pointed questions and comments. You know, I was happy when I saw on your slide number on page 8, slide number 16. That on the expansion of furniture industry, that in November 2008, furniture incubator will start in Mthatha. You know, these are the type of things that we would want to see as you actually deal with one area to area. We would need to have an indication as to, you know, how far have we worked in terms of plan, and when are things going to start shaping up? You know, like on your page 3, the National Tooling Initiative was launched in March 2007. I don't know whether it was in 2007, because when you were making the presentation, you indicated 2008. I don't know which is which. And if it was launched in 2007, we're expecting to get some information as to where we are at the moment with that program. The empowerment on page 5, the empowerment on page 5, slide 10, you know, the last sentence or bullet point, formulate an empowerment plan for the sector to be completed by December 2008, fine. But to me, empowerment issues, all sectors started long time ago dealing with those things. sector, BEE scorecards, etc. How does that link with such work that was done by different industries? On the challenges on the chemicals, that is slide 13 on page 7. You indicated something very important there, that outstanding issues of securing sufficient land is being attended and so on. And land is a critical issue in the country. Very critical, and it doesn't have to. I know the processes of land redistribution and land changing hands. It's very, very contested. I don't know, how are you actually managing that particular area? And you also indicate the challenges in securing preference for domestic manufacturers in tender processes, and you have requested us to play some influence in this area. I think we need to get more flesh, some details around this issue of tender processes, because it's a difficult issue in South Africa, particularly in the public sector, especially when it comes to local industry, or sometimes even when it involves external international industries who come and invest here. There's this problem that has been raised by the commissioner, public service commissioner, time and again, that these things, the public servants actually look into them benefiting before actually they approve things, or they would actually manipulate processes in that. If they want Company B to win the tender, they would then trade documents that come from other companies with that particular, so that they actually shape their tender documents in such a way that they win, because they know that they are traveling at the same time. So if those things are, I don't know what are the problems here. But we would need to be more informed about the problem. And the issuing of water licenses is critical. Water Affairs and Forestry, they have gone into shaping their strategies some time ago, created new institution to assess where, you know, areas where there's enough water and areas where there are shortages of water. I think at this stage, they should be ready to say what is it, you know. So this I hope that this is not going to delay the process of implementing the action plan. Chair, coming back to the Monyeta, page 12. Slide 24, Monyeta Work Readiness Program. Which department is in charge of this Monyeta, or institution, would need to know, so that this Monyeta funding to train people, you know, we should also, as public representative, inform our people so that they participate. You said other infant industries have grown up and need no protection. We don't know which ones are those. Perhaps can you enlighten us? That is on slide 27. Enlighten us which are those. The issue of capacity, I would link it, Chair, with the issue of coordination. Capacity in your directorate or the section of the industrial policy action plan, We don't know how many you are in the first place. And what are the problems? Are you well capacitated in terms of staff and in terms of skills? I think we should have actually known that even before now, and as an ongoing oversight process from the committee. We are doing oversight now, but I don't think it is sufficient. We need to be actually maybe sometimes going out and checking on your section as to how things are going, because this is a very, very important work that you are doing for us. Skills and capacity, we would need to know that. And coordination, you know, the problem that we always face in the trade and industry. Trade and industry, some directorates are actually in charge they are in charge because they are not authorized. You know, they are given some mandate to coordinate and drive, like the industrial policy action plan, but with less authority. That is a worrying factor. Maybe you can, with less authority, that you can actually go command those other sections and sister departments who deal with land, who deal with water and other things. Can you talk to that, whether you have enough power to drive the strategy, or does the department have enough power? The textile issue, last one from me. We cannot compromise this. I think we agree with you fully. Cannot compromise that. We need to stabilize and promote that sector. Because you go to the Eastern Cape, it actually deals with issues of traditions and culture, like in the Western Cape. You know, you go to the Northwest, you go to the Free State, the Shoshone, you see, and many other things. Things that might, you know, may in future be exported to various other nations outside South Africa. So we support you there, and then that work that you are doing, I think we must say we applaud you. Thank you, sir.
Viva.
Thanks. Professor Chiroko is saying that you spoke more than his 5 minutes. Good folks.
You are supposed to be the last.
I would like us to... I've noted you, Professor Chek. I would just like us to break for 15 minutes for
Yebo.
Yebo.
Then we can come back and people can get more food.
Doctor,
you're my friend.
Doctor,
when are we going overseas? We're not this year.
Let's ask the chief.
Then, anything we're not going overseas this year. Election mode.
We'll try and get overseas.
Huh?
Overseas, you can vote while you're overseas.
Well, that's going to be next year.
No,
this year. This year. Are we going to have election this year, Ben?
Next year.
I think next year, yes. I think
he's jumping to the next year party.
No, I agree with you, David. Food must come first.
Yeah.
But they say it's a beautiful. Look, crude oil is going up to such a high rate now. They say $200 a barrel.
Yeah.
That many people that couldn't make a viable existence on small scale farming can now start producing these crops because it's so high.
It's more scale farmers.
Yeah, there's sort of nut they say that you can.
No, it is a problem of rain sensing that. Government say that when rain plants, you know, one thing is more farmers who never.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
You know, that is a presentation, it is good, you know, but, you know, really, I want to say something from my heart, you know, I didn't see any future for the poor of our people in the rural or those women, you know, who is raising child at all. You know, that is one, you know, from the policy I look, you know, I don't think that is, our DDR, even understand what our country is facing at the moment, and what kind of industries that we should go after for. I want to ask the DDR, have you ever thought about this? For all these presentations, you put the industries there, all right? Which one for the normal people is easy to get in, to be invested in this country? If anybody can come to this country to put up the motor factories, our steel factories, all about biological factories, easy as other industries, because, you know, the threshold is very high. So how can you expect them to create jobs? And how long are you going to invite in a new investor to invest this kind of thing? You know, this is, I think that in the industry, you know, the trade industry, you have to look on these things. We're talking about Vietnam. Let's talk about Vietnam. Vietnam, yes, their labor is cheap, but they know what they need, right? So, because clothing industry is very low threshold, it's really very easy. You bring not only the investor to open a factory for you, but it is also observed all the workers from the rural areas, which is no education or low education. You know, my colleague, you know, the professor Durek, right? He's talking about is killing of the colored people in here, but he doesn't know. If the cat, our, you know, that is the free state, used to be a big base for export of clothing to the USA. Go there. Go to Butabello, go to the Tobancho, go to the Bazaar. It is a gold city. It's a gold city now. It used to be a 40,000 workers there. I don't know, for the past 10 years, why our government wants killing all those industries. You know, the other thing is that, you know, maybe the people we say the clothing is not our, it's not our future, but it's a surprise for this trip when I was in the Far East. I was told, American, the labor force, 50 to 60%, it is the clothing. And this is shocking. And even the developing country, nobody will give up this industry. But our government is give up. And this is very sad, you know. And the other thing I wanted to say, when I was in Taiwan this time, I went to visit, you know, this is a very old gentleman, he's previous president of the President Lee. You know, because he is a very famous, you know, agriculture economist, and also he was successful to bring Taiwan into one state to the other state. So I asked him one question. I said, look, listen, my country, we have one problem, is our economy is growing, it's booming. But in the meantime, we lost a lot of jobs. Our, you know, the job losing, unemployment also very high. You know, can you tell me what the reason? Nobody can answer me when I was asking all our people in here. You know what? It's not even take 1 second he gave me one day. He said, look, your government, one thing he didn't think about it. Yes, he said, the capital industry, it is important, but you must look, if your country still have a lot of labor force, he said, you cannot give up the labor-intensive job, the industry. He said the one mistake your government doing is that they only forecast of capital industries, and they neglect the labor-intensive one, and which is, he said, most of the developing countries, nobody will do that. Nobody will do that. I will go a little slow, enough because otherwise, you know, my brain is jumping, you know, from one to the other. And I want to answer, you know, but the talking about Chinese shop. We're talking about a lot of Chinese shops in this country. Why our people cannot do? How can they do? The cooler is not giving them the supporting financial. Okay, and all those material is imported from overseas. Okay, I want to ask you here, have you thought about, you know, to starting to have some kind of incentive to say, let's give the all the small shops, the owner, they have to import the goods to China. So, you know, the DTI says, I will pay the ticket. I will bring you there. Let's go there to do central buying. You know, central buying, and you know, you come with me to see what we should buy. What we should buy. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that if everybody wants to sell the banana in the same time. As I said, you create a market to the competition. All right? But if you don't help those small shop or local people, they cannot. They don't know where to get the material. They cannot. And you cannot blame those Chinese because they come from their country. All right? And they come here, they have some kind of financial support at home. Not here. Not here, right? Yeah. So you want to compete with them. The only thing is our government must also, you know, just to say, okay, now let's do all those small shops, right? I pay the ticket for you. Let's go together and let's decide what room to buy. Maybe just once a year, after a few times. Right? They might be starting, and also maybe at the beginning the government, you know, the DTI or IDC, I don't know who, you know, they will say, let's be your agents to buy and hold all the stuff for you. That is the only way. And we're talking about lack of skill, lack of capacity, lack of knowledge, right? And, you know, lack of knowledge, and really I think it's a lack of education. You know, no matter how much you don't think our country should go with this low end, what you call it, you know, the closing industries of the labor intensive one. I speak from my heart. Please think about those mothers who is in the rural area. Who is the one supporting the family for the children to be educated? We want to move from micro to the macro. How? By talking or by those few people from overseas? They come in here, they buy either the existing of industries, like they buy, you know, First National Bank or the bank, and create no job. Or you think we have to give the job to those mothers who are supporting their children to be educated. Then those children can bring us from the micro to the macro. That is the only way I can see. You know, from the first to the second. There's no way you can push someone to go to second without any the material supporting. And I was very surprised to see the model industry of 4.2%. We all know our previous minister is thinking about it. Only model industry is the king, is the star of this country. But as I said so many times, I was there for one time to see. They show me a BMW. My heart is beating. It's all the robots there. And talking about upgrade of clothing industry, tell me any of your policy guys understand clothing industry or not. I want to ask you, how are you going to upgrade? What kind of machine you think about upgrade? Do you know why the car industry can be upgraded? The only thing you can automatically to produce is if you don't change your product. Meaning, if you had product, produce the screw, you don't change that time. You don't even change with 2 years time. Yes. You can use automatic machine. How can you be automatic machine for your clothing? You must answer me. Because every buyer, they change the style, they change this, they can't do it. Okay. You know that is I have talked with Patea. He told me, he said, look, Christina, you're wrong. I'm helping the new wife to change the automatic machine for them. Please go to the DIY shop. The only styling DIY the produce by themselves is 501 or 505. They were changed, they didn't change for passing 50 years. That is why they can use the automatic machine. Because if they put the mold of the pocket, they don't change it. But do you know that? Each mold, if the buyer wants to change, only that mold costs you $5,000. Only change that mold. So if a buyer comes to buy 20,000 pieces, this one, they change the mold, even a quarter inch, you have to change the mold. You can't use it. So don't tell me that, you know, the clothing, the industry in our countries, you know, we are not upgrading now. We are. And the other thing, I want to say something for our neighbors here. I was coming from the East Coast. I knew the workers there. Some people from the Far East, they do the same study. They say the productivity, we compare April to April, okay, East Coast, my workers is not worse than the body. The only thing killing is working hours. You know, the working hours is we used to have 45 hours. In the 5 years, the law says 40 hours. China said 40 hours. Unfortunately, they are working for 88 hours. Oh. That is. You know, the other thing people doesn't understand. You know, the costing of the wages, it's not that much. 15 to 18%. But do you know the management fee, how high management fee? 25%. So if you took the management fee divided by 40 hours or 30 hours or 80 hours, you know why we lost. Why we lost. And this is what the argument I also talk to unions, to a lot of unions, to say, you have to fight everybody to have the same working hours and stick on it. You know, not we are not fighting for, you know, to say who has to buy more, who has to buy less. Because it, as I said, in the wages, the difference is not that big difference. If you control well, if your efficiency is you control well, number one. Number two, you know, we're talking about patient side. Why we cannot make patient side? Because of, you know, they, you know, for the, you know, why if they use patient side, they can do overtime. They put extra force there. If we do the same thing, we can also do the patient side. So I think that this is the thing you must think about it. No? And I do say that in our countries, in a short, urgent, not even short, in urgent policy is to create jobs for those women in the rural area who have no education. And I didn't see anything on this, on the policy. As I said, you know, you're talking about motor industry, you give them $223 billion RRCP, the duty rebate. We know it. Nobody there even to touch this subject, right? They drop. And there's no job creation. DCC is not even $1 billion, but it creates a lot of jobs. You know, and the other thing I want to say, you know that DCC for the expansion with limited tradability. To limited tradability, the idea is to say, because closing industry, they're selling DCC to the third party, and they discount, about 20% discount. But do you know that after they're limited the tradability, do you know what those poor closing manufacturers, the discount, they at the moment is 50%. The 50%. You know what, you know, this is the thing that's hurting. Because they're limited of the manufacturer, they can buy. So those limited buyer now, all right? They say, no, you can only buy, you can either you give me 50% discount or 65% discount, I'm not going to take it, and it happens. Because all the clothing is dying. And please, the other thing I want to say, when you're thinking about, you know, policies for this labor intensity, think about the other, also your brothers in Saku. I think that is very, you know, like you put in a importer quota, you should invite into one board. And you know, it will be better control. You know, the quota system, it is good. But the way we allocate to the people is not good. So now, here, all these chains, though, they are controlled, manufactured local. They don't even buy from local. Because why should they buy? The manufacturer in local, they don't have quota, they still have quota. And if they are lack of quota, they just go to the DDI to say, look, to cry, to say, look, listen, you know, I'm sure there's quota. They just give. There's no formula at all. So either you have to cancel, if we are going to do it again, please let's do it in the right way. And let some of manufacturers and also invite the other four countries to be on the board together. And everybody can be happy and be more controlled in that one. Okay? And the one thing I want to say, if any DCC, if we are going to change to tradable DCC, I want you to make very sure the shipping agent is not allowed, for what is not allowed to buy. And this is, you must write it down. Because they are the person abused a lot. Because they are the person, you know, they buy it, they make huge of the profit of it. It's happened even now. Manufacturing. They're using some manufacturing, they know how to play the game. I think that is the one thing, no matter what kind of DCC tradability you are going to put, make sure the forwarder, the shipping agent is not allowed to be part of it. You can be an importer, you can be the retailer, whatever, but not the shipping agent. The other thing is, you see, I used to say, we try, a lot of people talking about, you know, the privatization of a lot of SOE. I personally say, if any of the product is the output of this SOE is other intelligent input, it shouldn't be privatized. Mm-hmm. If any SOE output it is another industry's input, you are not allowed to privatize. It's like telecom. When they privatize, the privatize we want to be lower, right? What happens? They double the price. So why you privatize it? And they're killing all industries. So why would they ESCO is not allowed? And it has to be controlled. Even government has to subsidy for all the difference they have to, because their output is other industry input. In China, one thing they don't allow, even privatize, which is dangerous. You know, the government, they put a lot of money to subsidize for this the crude oil. Only one reason, because their output is only other industry's input. So you have to consider this input to that this industry to be competitive. Because you're supporting one, that is the output item, which is the other industry input item. You can save your government a lot of incentive to all the other industries. That is, I think, you have to bear in your mind. You know, I just say that the last one that is, I used to say, the China say, one province with three words, meaning they know in their countries, with one province, they have developed, developing and underdeveloped in the same province, but they manage it well. And in South Africa, we might have two words. So I think the challenge is there, but you know, we should be able to deal with. You know, we really should be able to deal with this kind of situation, you know, trying really, really, as I said, you know, please look on those poor women and poor child in the rural area, and to try to make your industry policy to forecast that one, not forecast the motors and the buyers, and buy without, you know, your policies, they are growing. You give them one incentive, they're growing, all right? They don't need any policy for those people. You can just give them the one or two sentences. But the really, for this labor intensive, you know, particularly for those poor people, you do need the policy to help them there. Thank you.
Eva.
Professor Cheng, thank you. Congratulations.
Thanks. First, I'd just like to comment about process because I've been listening, you know, attentively to the various inputs. It might be helpful at some stage maybe we explore joint sanctions more than the linear approach that's taking place, because as the Portfolio Committee for Trade and Industry, rightfully so, we interact with DCI, we then take issues back to the cabinet and then we expect responses. We do not interact with some of the other stakeholders within the state that we need to either influence or get influence in. Once one also takes into cognizance and respect the fact that other portfolio committees, even other departments, their rights to and competences to do their own job. But I'm sure part of our drive is to ensure efficiency in government delivery. As a result, it would do no harm and do more benefit, in fact, if you could interact more with the various portfolio committees and also maybe invite one or two people from other departments just to exchange views with them, really and literally exchange views with them. Because it's not the first time that such concerns have been expressed. I'll go page by page from my side as well. With regard to page 4, reference was made that there needs to be a broader policy response to transport program. It would be helpful if Mr. Nimrod can expand on that. Because the investment that you got from the minister's budget vote speech recently was that they seem to be very much intent to invest quite strongly on public transport. But, I think the chair of the portfolio committee, Comrade Jeremy, was saying that the budget has, or one sector of the budget had actually multiplied fourfold. Uh, The other area is the plastics industry. I wasn't clear when Mr. Imbor was making reference to essential interventions that are essential there. If you could elaborate once again. Wood, paper, and pulp and furniture. Now, it seems beneficiation programs admirably are there for Eastern Cape with the furniture incubator, MTATA. But what about KZN? When are we, is that part of the details that are coming, or will there be no beneficiation programs in KZN? And what are about other subsectors still within this sector generally, not geographically? Are there no opportunities for equipment and other whatever related sectors? What would be also of interest is the role of municipalities, given the geographical location of the key projects that are articulated, particularly in Base 8. We might also appreciate if you could get an update on the economic empowerment developments around there, particularly in this sector. The second slide in page 9 seems to be indicating a dim future, and is that the prognosis that the delegation is giving us, particularly on the two sectors except the furniture sector? Coming to clothing and textiles, well, a lot has been said about that. My question is, when it comes to CSIR, is there any coordination that the department is doing with CSIR? And also, just out of interest, CSIR on its own, having a standard of excellence to ensure that there is progress in strengthening this industry, do they have any outreach program that you know of any? And in terms, when it comes to your way forward, I do have a couple of questions. The first one is that you have a task team on illegal imports. It would be of interest if you just to know the extent of involvement on SMME in that task team, particularly those on the lower end. I assuming that they are the hardest hit. The CETA for clothing, textiles, footwear, and leather, well, admirably, you say that should be part of the way, way forward to consider upscaling skills there. But the question then I have is that currently, what type of and how much investment by the public sector and the private sector has been done on that skills and recruitment program? It's good to say that we need to do that, but are there any pointers that show that there has already been some good footing? And of course, Chair, I've been triggered amongst other things with that authoritative information that the CETA's terms have not been popular in terms of delivery, with a lot of expense and budget overrun. The medium long-term innovation on technology plan for the sector, what does that entail? And lastly, still on this area, Chair, is that a lot is being said, and obviously one would really endorse that, but a wider question is that right now, do you have any joint programs with the Department of Labor and as well as the clothing and textile industry, the captains of the industry themselves? So, my understanding is that you are strongly emphasizing that there needs to be upscaling of skills, well, of course, upgrading of capital and a few other things. And to me, particularly on the upscaling of skills, if not, I would definitely strongly and formally propose that we should approach the cabinet to whatever appropriate means and ensure that is enforced. 30,000 learners on Munyesa Work Readiness Program. Father Gates, it would be just helpful if the CTI is in a position to do so. If not, that's understandable. Why only 30,000 learners? Couldn't we have more? I must just add my caution and uneasiness on the biofuels, because recently aspects, not just within South Africa, but worldwide, there have been an outcry and extra caution and caution on this on the biofuels industry. And the reference is made to national consultation in this industry. Now the question is, how was this done and with whom? Also, it is claimed that when it comes to the AXGISA sector, only three sectors have been highlighted. What are the other sectors? Well, of course, I'm aware that even the presentation contains and overlaps with some of the AXGISA sectors. Or shall I correctly assume then that all the sectors within AXGISA have been covered? The last area, Chair, is industrial financing and upgrading in base 18. What one understands that areas have been listed there, enterprise growth program, but recently one of the things that has been raised strongly is that we need to concentrate on the agro industry as well, agricultural industry. One would assume that the role and the angle to which the guy could come in is not what the Department of Agriculture would do, but it's on inputs such as equipment, whether assemblies or direct manufacturing of equipment to ensure that inputs are lowered. It may be a new area, but I'm still would be provocative enough, Chair, to say, have they considered that? Because strong signals are coming and comments are coming that if amongst other solutions on food prices is to ensure that we intensify the agricultural program. So within the context of industrial policy, so I'm really provoking that. Are you beginning to handle that and see whether, what role are you playing? It's not a weather effect in any case. What role would you be playing? Because my understanding up to now, with the little that I have, is that I've already realize that it's only IDC that has something on agro industry, which is the agro processing. Page 14 is the intra-government coordination, that is around challenges. Care about this. What's the role on the work of the cabinet? I'm not saying that DDI should give judgment, but just to indicate, because some of the things is about how they interact with National Treasury, the letter of clarity on requisite business case. But our understanding is that the cabinet meets every second Wednesday. And this is where now there's integration and coordination of things. The minister puts the thing, and then the other ministers present, and under the leadership of the presidency, issues are coordinated. So honestly, that question does ring in my mind, and I'll make comments as I go through that. It kept on coming that, well, if this is the situation, well, has there been any role or help or guidance from the, or any strong firm position from the cabinet to say, look, this is what is happening and what's happening, and is anything we have, as a matter of record, Chair, in the past raised our uneasiness about the underfunding of CEDA, the slow approval of direct lending by COOLA. Historically, we knew that the co-op support unit has been by and large grant funded. If there's anything now where the budget vote is coming, it could be, we don't know, one can just guess, it might still be a little bit minimal. And also summer, those are the four. I don't know how many times this has been raised. And so that's just one also experience that one has. Just as an interest as well on the reduction of input costs, the president has raised quite a number of areas on the cost of doing their business. Is there any distinct body of knowledge that has been sort of consolidated now as we move along to say this is what we are doing, whether it's DPI or the economic cluster, with regard to reduction of of the cost of doing business. The policy say it's a little bit outside, but I think it would have an impact and it would give us a stronger picture on what the presenters are saying. Export tax on scrap, very much supported, but it triggers another thing. What about the trade policy? Because I think the export strategy has been presented to us, and when it was presented, the ease of trade policy came in. Am I linking oranges to apples, or is there a direct linkage? Because I argue that, amongst other things, you know, we can also articulate and argue more formatively were we to be in a position to understand what the trade policy on export tax. I don't think what is there is not enough. Also, the monopolistic pricing of inputs, maybe the jargon at times says is a bit high, so a brief document would be helpful so that we can engage in future on that. The functioning of support schemes and systems, as I said, the cabinet and even the president, okay, if there's unhappiness about the extent to which support schemes and systems from other departments are coming, what then is the situation? And Chair, we are being presented with the progress on EPAF, and already a couple of challenges are emerging. Now, at the end, I had a few things that I also wanted to throw in as a question, but loaded questions unavoidably. The first one is, what is the exact role and input of the economic cluster on EPAF? When I listen at the end of the day, all what has been said, even the comments from other honorable members, you know, the DTI is the coordinator convener at the epicenter of the economic cluster of the executive, correct, Baba Zigotene? But then I'm asking that you're at the epicenter of a collective. But then can we get a little bit about this collective? Because we don't drive as DTI in the whole of the economy of the country. We do it in conjunction with others. But what are their role and input? Number two, is there a common vision that is genuinely shared within the economic cluster? That's why I said my questions are loaded, you know. Do you genuinely share a common vision, you know, to say? My understanding, when the National Industrial Policy Framework was presented to us, that for once, this is going to be one of the standard pieces of our economic transformation. We'll drive it such that it has ripple effects even in other sectors of the economy. Now, obviously, one would assume that if that's the case, the other members of the economic cluster would do their best. In fact, we would even expect that when we get regular updates, such as today, we would get the input that they look, this is what other departments have tried their best to strengthen our resolve and to strengthen the implementation of EPAS. I've already mentioned of the position of the cabinet, even on this, I mean on other issues, but also on these very two questions. If I respect if they are uneasy about that, it's quite sensitive, but I'll ask you, has the cabinet pronounced itself, has it made observations on what is seemingly an untenable or an emergently untenable situation? Lastly, Chair, having heard even from the Minister himself of Trade and Industry that the industrial policy is fairly fundamental. Honestly, I would have expected at least one of the ministers would have been there. It's understandable with the DG, even with the DG. Wouldn't it have been helpful for him to come and strengthen, you know, your hand here? We all concur that the industrial policy is fairly fundamental. It's going to serve as a culture, one of the strongest, if not the strongest, catalyst for economic transformation. Thank you.
Thank you. That was quite a full basket of comments and questions on the basis of a very extensive input as well.
I've lost the KG now.
Yeah, that's good. That's different. Mine is just a very brief remark in regard to voluntary restraint or coaches. Last week I had the occasion to interact a few times with members of the South African Clothing and Textile Workers Union, and the report that Ibrahim Patel gave in one of those meetings, and with an illustration with regard to a number of factors, was that in fact the voluntary restraint did work, and he gave a case study of several factories as to how they were able to utilize this voluntary restraint in order to pick up production in regard to those factories. So it seems that there isn't a clear-cut view in regard to whether this is working or whether it's not working. But as I say, from this particular union that's involved in the sector, there's a very positive report that the Secretary General has given. Members of the department here have heard quite a number of comments, concerns in regard to the challenges. Could we have your response? And then we'll see how far we can go. It's obviously a matter that we won't be able to exhaust completely today, but I'm sure I do not want to preempt what you're going to say, but also to say to members some of the issues we will be able to raise in our budget debate, I think, next week. So we are going to canvass quite a number of issues and see which angle we take on that. Over to you, the other.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks very much from the members. Really, it has been an incredible input. Well, we take some of these input as comments. We just have to go back and work on those. Again, I just want to start with your comment, Chairperson, that yes, that's really the understanding of the department, that the voluntary quotas did assist a lot of industries in South Africa. If maybe there was an understanding that we are saying they didn't work, that wasn't the intention at all. I think most, let's say from the input we are getting from industry, that they did work. Obviously, there will be those people who say they didn't work. But overall, that's the understanding from our side. Chair and members of this committee, the biggest problem really that we are facing, you know, the biggest problem that if this committee could help us solve, then maybe our work could be easier going forward, is the coordination and alignment of government policies and acts of parliament. You know, if you look at the development of industrial policy, it really came later than other policies of government. For instance, if you take the TPPFA, TPPFA basically focuses on the price. As a government official, you go out there and get the cheapest in town. That's basically what it's focusing on. The other areas like BEE, you know, disabled people, doesn't focus on those. Of course, they are very small. So if you come now later with industrial policies that focuses on industrial development that focuses on bringing in disadvantaged people, then you have a clash of government policy. So we need alignment of these policies. If I can make an example, exactly like Nimrod presented, the ARV tender, the Department of Health says, you know, we also do things according to an act of parliament, that is to get the cheapest in house, you know, to get the maximum value, then get for your money. If you come now with this industrial policy, that will really not allow you to choose, you know, the least price, the least price, but the guy who can get you or give you industrial development in that particular area, you know, in terms of assisting suppliers, smaller suppliers, assisting those people that, then we have a problem. That's exactly the problem we have. Because, again, really, they are not breaking the law by refusing to agree with us. There is an act of parliament that allows us to do that. So really, we need to look at this act of parliament and try to align it. You see, unfortunately, most of them are outside of our control. Like the CCFA, the National Trade is the custodian of that act. They are the ones who have to take it to parliament and try to align it with all these new acts that are trying to promote some aspects of the economy and the society. The CSDP, the Customer Sector Development Program of the GPE, you know, it was the whole program was started with all good intentions. But obviously, because of lack of experience, maybe, you know, people, they didn't realize that the Department of Trade and Industry, because it is the department that is responsible for the development and facilitation of enterprises, they are the ones who take the lead in the program. Not to play, you know, a secondary role to approve something that has been agreed upon by, you know, procurement managers of the SOE. We are the department that has to go out there, negotiate with industry. As far as this procurement that is coming, you know, procuring of wagons, you know, of railway coaches, the local industry, which part can they play in terms of supplying into those contracts, in terms of increasing their capabilities for export on those products? You know. It's not a procurement manager sitting at Transnet that will have to determine that. So there's a problem there. It also goes down to areas like toy fuels and forest and wood and pulp. You know, today we know that in the wood and pulp forestry sector, the upstream is controlled by three companies. Really. Then we have a problem downstream where small sawmillers play. They don't have a supply of wood and logs because the guys who are controlling the factory, you know, they determine which product goes to who. Now, if, like we say, that we want to change the picture, make smaller companies own the factory, own the forest. But then for you to do that, we have to plant more forest. For you to plant more forest, you need water licenses from Water Affairs. But you see, Water Affairs says we are a country that doesn't have a lot of rain, so you can't have a lot of commercial forests around. So you face these problems, you know, because they say a lot of these commercial forests, they absorb a lot of water. Same thing when you come to biofuel. You know, there are plants or crops that could be used in biofuels. That's not necessarily challenge of or increase the threat of food security. But then these plants in South Africa are recognized as alien plants that can be used. And one of those plants is jatropha. In other countries they use jatropha because jatropha is just toxic plants. It can be consumed by humans or animals, but you know, it runs wild in the fence, but it consumes a lot of water. The Department of Land Affairs and Department of Water Affairs, they say, no, there's no way you can use that kind of a plant. So, besides, you know, the challenges of crisis themselves, because again, the crisis also causes a problem, where you find that a lot of maize farmers today will want to convert into whatever crop that fits into by fuel, because there the price will be better. But there are plans really that we could use, but then the other departments say just no way can use that. So really, it's an issue of coordination and alignment of these acts of parliament, you know, that were developed prior to the industrial policy. Again, I just want to commend the Department of Transport, because really with all these big procurement that they are about to do, they are working very closely to the Department of Trade and Industry. Even the chief executive of South African Railway Committee, South African Railway Commuter Services, I think that's how they call it, has been to the DTI, you know, trying to force this coordination so that when they do this massive procurement, you know, local industry benefits in that. I'll let my colleagues to come in and I'll come in.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, I think Larry just let me start off with two apologies. The one is, I think next time we print out the slides, we definitely need to print them perhaps larger. We've heard it from a number of members. But I think the more serious apology is if I think that, you know, clearly there was a misunderstanding about our statements about the impact of the quotas, you know, and perhaps we didn't articulate that strongly enough. But I think we have to say very, very strongly, and I don't believe in any way suggested that that we believe that the quotas were not effective. We believe that the quotas were effective. So I think we need to clarify that. What we are saying, though, is that let's say the quotas are necessary but not sufficient. So, and hence we are suggesting a number of measures that will take the industry forward. And I think that a number of points that Professor Chang has made is useful on this front. You know, in making our look, and I think the decision has not been made yet. You know, should the quotas continue or not? And I think that's a matter that needs to be decided. But I think the point that Professor Chang is making is very important. If they do, how do we take some of the lessons? You know, I think one is, you know, are we adequately including the other blocking countries in the process? I know that there's a big concern that's been raised from industry that says, you know, that there's problems that it's introduced problems in relation to access to textiles. We don't know how, you know, it's one of the things that we're looking at. In fact, internally, we are now starting a review of the impact of the quotas. I mean, we've done initial reviews, but even though the process will only complete at the end of December, but our view is, you know, we believe very strongly, at least on the balance of the evidence, that the quotas have been effective. So I think we just need to make that absolutely clear. And then in terms of the responses, I mean, I think that the perhaps try to respond maybe sector by sector and according to the set of issues that have been raised. Look, I think a number of issues have been raised around coordination. I just want to make a proposal to the committee that perhaps what we should do in a formal letter, in a formal document, is actually set out a list of issues with this committee that we would ask them to engage on. you know, that where we believe that, you know, that, that we require the, you know, the engagement of the committee with the counterparts and other committees. So that's just a practical proposal, so that we're very, very clear what those issues are. That's, I think that's the one thing. I think a number of issues have been raised, but how well do the existing mechanisms work? I mean, I think we, you know, have we've given a bit of an unbalanced view in the sense that we've emphasized the areas where we are having difficulty with coordination, but I think that coordination has improved through the cluster system, and I think that the industrial policy has helped with that coordination, and it's kind of focused people's minds, you know. But the reality is that when it comes down to very, you know, there are issues where departments have differences of opinion, or, you know, those things are, because of the whole nature of the way the cluster system is constructed, no department generally does other treasures. You know, it's a consensual kind of thing. So I think that, so even though these things are raised in the cluster, they may be raised in cabinet, they're not, you know, kind of, you know, they're not necessarily decisively dealt with. So, you know, that's, I think that's the reality, you know, of how some of these things play out. Then, I think that Professor Truoff raised issues about, and one of his concerns was, you know, on the one hand, he's saying, we obviously need to support jobs, but we want to keep, we don't want to punish, especially poor consumers. So what is the interaction, I think, between trade and competition policy? That's a key issue. So to give an example, there's a lot of people who would argue that, okay, well, just cut your tariffs, your import tariffs, and then everything will be cheaper. But that's not necessarily true, because whether or not something will be cheaper, or in fact, it will be cheap at all, depends on the value chain, and it depends on the levels of concentration and behavior in the value chain. You might, for instance, say, well, let's cut tariffs on agricultural imports. But if you've got concentration along the value chain, that doesn't automatically translate into cheaper prices. So there's very complex kind of interactions here, and I think that's where the role of competition is so strong. And I know there was a call for more detail, but as I indicated earlier, I mean, I think there's going to be a whole series of public hearings on this. Might not be the best time, also in the context of many, many other issues that have been raised, to go into great detail on them. Then I think that another issue that was raised is, will raising productivity in clothing and textiles mean capital intensity and the promotion of, you know, capital intensity and job losses? And I think we're not saying that at all. You know, I think what we're saying is, when we mean productivity, we mean, you know, people must become more productive. So workers through skills development, firms through the process efficiencies, also parties through the equipment that they use, how they manage their value chain and their relationship with retailers and so on, with their customers. So it's all of those things. Issues around the teacher and the training program. The teachers, different sectoral teachers, have performed. Their performance has been variable, let's just say, and I think everybody recognizes that. But I think generally the clothing textile leather footwear teacher is one of the better teachers, and we think that they are a suitable partner. Now, we haven't got to the point where we're saying, well, this is the kind of funding that's required, et cetera, et cetera. But what's interesting is that what's been done on the business process outsourcing side with the Monietla program, I think that, there's a useful precedent there where we said, look, we want to upscale this new industry. And the Department of Labor came to the table. Look, it took time and it was a complex issue. So I think there's that precedent. So, I think we can strike those arrangements across departments. There's a question raised, look, should this program, the clothing, be predominantly focused on rural areas or not in urban areas? I that's very, very complex. I think what we're saying is, look, let's put in place a good program to support the industry, and And I think that the geographic location will, it will support activities in a variety of geographic locations. So we're not saying, well, we'll only do it in rural areas, and then we won't support the kind of urban Western Cape industry. So it's got to be both, I think. Then there were issues on the public transport. What do we see as the linkage of industrial policy? There are two main things. I mean, one is commuter rail. That's obviously a huge opportunity. And given that there's already, we're already having investments in freight, in the freight side, and the technologies are not that different. There's opportunities for synergy and economies of scale. Where we can focus on building productive capacity that can supply both the freight and the commuter rail side. But I think that we've got to embed a number of principles in this program, and also in the supply development programs that are being led by DPP, and we've raised this matter with DPP to say, look, first of all, you've got to show very clearly in the supply development program, how is this going to be done, where do the obligations lie? I think that's the one thing. The second is that we must embed a principle that says you must take into account life cycle costing. So in other words, you don't just go for the absolutely cheapest product, but you take into account how much is it going to cost. So you can import an engine for a train from somewhere else, and it will be, on the face of it might be cheaper, but what is the life cycle cost? Because that engine needs to be maintained. Are you going to then fly people out, first class, engineers from Germany or wherever, to come and maintain that thing? So let's embody that principle of life cycle cost, and let's also embody the principle of wherever something can be competitively localized, let's localize. Those are some of the principles you want to see embodied in these things. In relation to public transport strategy, we think there's a big opportunity around rail, but also buses. Assembly of buses in South Africa. I think that's going to be an important opportunity to unlock. Then just a correction: National Tooling Initiative. I think it was a typo, launched in March 2008, not March 2007. On the autos, there were questions about empowerment and, how is that linking into the codes and so on. I mean, I think that what's happening in the auto sector, and one can compare it in some ways to the financial services sector, is that I think those industries are looking at some of the flexibilities that are built into the code. So for various reasons, strategic and whatever, they may not want to give up huge amounts of ownership of equity. But that means they must do more on the other sides of the other elements of the code, like training and management and procurement and all of these things. So I think that's the balance that's going to be struck in the auto industry. And how, in relation to the code. Then there was a question, these year-on-year figures, autos, there was a decline. I mean, I think this is more of a snapshot of what has happened in the first quarter of this year. So this doesn't represent the long-term trend of autos, which is set out further in the presentation and is very, very clear. I mean, it's upward. But there were just some specific things that happened last in this quarter, and I think the predominant thing is obviously the energy situation. You might see, every industry goes through these fluctuations. It doesn't mean that our auto sector is declining. It just means in the first quarter, you know, there was a temporary decline in output relative to the last quarter. And probably what it means is that they because of electricity, they didn't produce as much as they would have in this quarter, but they'll catch up then probably in the following quarter. Then, and similarly, then there were questions, chemicals and plastics and pharmaceuticals. I mean, the one question is, look, why are there these, you know, you're seeing growth in, you know, in areas like basic chemicals, other chemicals, but then why are the jobs going down? For instance, in basic chemicals. I mean, I think what's happening there is you're getting more capital intensity. That's the one thing. The other thing, I think, is that, and this is a common phenomenon across manufacturing, is that you're getting a lot of outsourcing and of various functions and casualization in some places. So what you see then is some of these activities which are actually taking place in manufacturing are showing up in things like business services because of labor brokers and things like that. So that could be part of the, you know, the reason. And then the question, you know, also will look, you know, where's the kind of really strong plan around plastics? And I think that, I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that some of the sector work is uneven, you know. And it's something that we've recognized internally. We need a bigger push around plastics. We probably actually need a dedicated strategy around plastics in the same way that we said we need a dedicated strategy around furniture. So there are some efforts in this regard, lowering input costs, you know, identifying particular investment projects and so on, but that in it probably doesn't amount to an adequate and, you know, comprehensive response to that sector. And I think that's something that we've just got to keep working on, you know, as we take this work forward. Then, similarly on forestry paper and pulp, the question here, you know, look, again, you've had this growth in wood and wood products, but then you've had the decline. In fact, wood and wood products and paper products. You've got this decline in employment. And I think, again, it's those two phenomena, again, these are both capital-intensive industries, possibly increasing their capital intensity, but I think there's also an issue of outsourcing going on here as well, probably, and probably right across manufacturing. There were issues raised about, I think, many issues around financing, and I think the one is really the need to look very seriously at the Public Procurement Act and how we leverage it much more seriously. And I think it can't just be cheapest cost with a kind of couple of other things tacked on. It's got to look at some kind of net social benefit. You know, it's got to have, you know, have broader mechanisms built in to allow for that. There was also issues raised, you know, if we get more money, can we spend it? I think that even internally, what we've been trying to do with our work with the sector is say, as you prepare your business plan, tell us how you're going to spend the money that you're asking for, because it's a matter of concern even internally to us. And I think that it goes back, it will be very, very critical is agreeing what are the criteria with Treasury for a business case for financing. And one element of those criteria is going to be how are you going to spend the money? So I think we can lock these disciplines. I think if we can reach that kind of agreement that we need, we need a set of criteria for a business case for financing, and that one of those criteria has got to be, you know, how are you going to effectively spend that money? So I think we can build in some of these issues into these criteria. I think the question has been, okay, we've talked on some aspects of sectors, but not others. And I think the big one that we haven't really spoken about is the whole agricultural and agro-processing value chain. And that's a huge issue obviously in the current context of, you know, rising food prices and so on. And I think that it's really something that needs a response across a number of departments. And I think that's something, it's one of the things that's on our agenda to drive in the next round of IPAP, and it's already, we're already starting to do much more serious work on agro-processing as we go forward, but it's going to require a multi-departmental response because it has, there are many issues involved. You've got primary agriculture, you've got issues of land and land restitution, land reform, you've got issues of agro-processing, you've got issues of financing. I mean, now the idea of maybe actually going back to subsidizing agriculture is maybe even back on the table. So I think there are all of these issues, but it has to be dealt with quite comprehensively. Then on the BPO, I mean, one question was, well, you know, we're targeting 30,000. Is that kind of aggressive enough? We be going for more. I think I think that's an entirely legitimate question, and I think what we should be doing in all of these programs is to say, look, where we've put in mechanisms that have worked, how can we massify those? How can we scale them up? You know, let's identify the things that have worked and then use that as a basis to scale up. So, you know, I think we need to look right across these strategies for those kinds of opportunities to scale up. Then I think, I mean, the biofuels debate is obviously, I mean, this you know, lies largely with Department of Minerals and Energy, but and in fact, a whole range of departments. Another cross you know, sectoral issue. I think that the one of the problems is I think that maybe we. I think that there are legitimate concerns with what is happening globally now with biofuels and the impact that it's having on food prices. But I think that we should just be careful not to throw the baby out of the bathwater. You know, so rather than saying, look, there are problems, let's not go for biofuels, maybe what we should be saying is let's learn the lessons. You know, in fact, we have the opportunity of learning from, you know, maybe where the U.S. has gone wrong and the EU has gone wrong. And build those in, and I think some critical, there are going to be some, you know, critical decisions. Which plant, you know, which crops do we include? Which crops do we exclude? That's very, very important. What technologies do we adopt? What kind of technologies do we adopt? I mean, one way of dealing with this, food security issues, to say, well, look, this can only take place on agricultural activity, in respect to agricultural activity that grows new hectareage. So you can't, if there's a mechanism, a subsidy or whatever, for people to grow crops for biofuels, you say you can't use that subsidy to take your existing maize crop and then instead of selling it into the food market, you sell it into the fuel market. So I think there's the intelligent mechanisms we can use to deal with some of these issues. And then lastly, there was a question, you know, what solar water heating, where are we and what needs to happen? Obviously, this kind of energy situation, there's a huge opportunity to roll out solar water heating. And from the point of view of Eskom, cheaper per unit of energy per kilowatt, to do solar water heating than it is to build a new power station per kilowatt or per megawatt, however you want to put it. So there is a strong imperative. It's a lot more complex than appears on the surface. The Eskom has said they want to roll out a million solar water heaters over 5 years, which means 200,000 per year. Where we are at the moment is that the capacity to manufacture and install in the country is about 10,000 a year. So that's the gap we've got to bridge, is go from 10,000 to 200,000. But that's a huge opportunity, but I mean also we've got to be realistic about how quickly we can scale up, you know. So it really it can be done, and it's a huge an opportunity for manufacturing. It's a big opportunity to create jobs on the installation side. To do that, there are a lot of things that have to happen. There's got to be a real imperative for a household to install solar water heating. And that's got to be a mix of saying, look, at some point in the future, we are going to make it mandatory that every new house, every user that's replaced, has a solar water element to it. We can't do that too soon, or we're going to actually hold up building in this country. So the sequencing of that is going to be critical. There's also got to be a proper financial incentive for households. It's cheapest on the market, we understand, even with the subsidy that Eskom currently gives under the demand side management program, is about 12,000 Rand. There are very few households in this country, even if they can get that money back in energy savings over 5 to 10 years, who are going to stump up front 12,000 Rand to put a solar water heater in their house. So there's big coordination issues around how is it going to be financed. There has to be a very large skills development program, because you need people who have both plumbing and electrical some kind of training in order to be able to install the solar water heating. So it's something that we are working on in the context of the National Energy Response Team. We think it's a massive opportunity. It's not simple, but it's a huge opportunity. Sorry, yes, I was asked, is that all? I think that's pretty much all.
Oh, okay. I thought somebody else wanted to make anything. Professor Cheng, I'll indulge you.
Thank you for this comprehensive response, you know. But you see, that one thing that is, before we close, I just want to say that is the thing that to put my concern, you know, just to more clear. Mm-hmm. What I do think is that, you know, that incentive costs must be less than, you know, that what I'm saying is, you know, if you give any incentive to the only industry, please try to look on how many jobs you can create it. I think it's really, really important is, if you give incentive, you know, modern industries have a lot of incentives. Took a little part, not even 10% of the incentive they enjoy to these closing industries, right? They can create it, you know, more than, you know, maybe 100 times of jobs of the motor industries, all right? And also, I also want to say that, you know, really, think about it, the threshold of to get into the closing, you can immediately create jobs. It's not so difficult as others. You know, others, you know, you might bring one or two of these big the capital incentive the industry to into this country. Number one, it took a long time. Number two, it is not going to create a lot of jobs. As I said, Yenna know that. So they took them for 20 or 25 years to bring all the closing industries. But last year they made really clear they are not welcome any other investor again from overseas for the closing. But you know, instead all IC people say, IC, you know, is also labor intensive. Right? But you know what I'm saying, it is a stage. But in our country now I can only say the closing for export, you know, but you know, just look on that thing. You're talking about the agriculture things. You know, agriculture the process things, and you admit it's a long way to go. But what I'm trying to tell you is that we don't have time. And that is what I'm saying. I would like to really you to look at all the industry policy that is, you know, we can immediately attract people, you know, to provide a job within half a year to a year. That is, I think so. And you're talking about solar water power thing. There's one thing people don't understand. Solar water power, you need the government to subsidy. Because the costing, you know, every cost of KW, you, I don't know whether anybody knows. If our government is going to sell, only the costing of that, to produce that KW, 1 KW is costing you 4.80 cents. Okay? But if you use coal power, the power station now is only 48 cents. But this is, that is, because you know, all the other countries, developed countries, our in Taiwan, they know it. They say the solar power thing, if you don't have a government and the subsidy, there's no way. Because the costing of it is very heavy. That's what I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. I would like to thank everyone. It's obvious that we can't just dispense with progress in regards to industrial policy in one session of the meeting. As was correctly said at the outset, this is a briefing on work in progress. So we will stay in touch with you in regards to this matter. And then obviously, I'm sure members will raise some of the aspects that have been said here in the various debates. And we will continue our interaction with you and then see when next the earliest opportunity will be there for us to again interact with yourself, just to touch base with some issues that you have raised with other members in the economic class and see what we can do from our end. Good folks, I'd like to thank everyone at this stage. They are only members of the ANC.
Yes,
so, and Professor, I would like us to remain so that we just look at some in-house methods for the ANC study group. Good folks, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
One very last thing is just the question was raised the indicate that our ministers in cabinet, both of our deputies are involved. So apologies for that.